Hey, you know, speaking of sneakiness, we're getting all kinds of feedback. I did not at any point, I don't recall advocating putting your tongue on a frozen lamppost, did I? On this airways. No, I did not advocate that as a new hobby. However, I did point out that it was done at one time. And this is a situation that you got to accept. It's just like there was a brief flurry at one time when I was about 10 of kids going down. It was a flurry of activity in this department. It was a kind of a new hobby that broke out. It was to go down to the railroad tracks where they had these trains that go by, and to put a penny on the track. Now the purpose of that particular curious hobby was to flatten the penny out. Now, at that point, what you did with the penny was entirely up to you. There wasn't much you can do with a flattened penny. However, that was a whole big thing, and I can remember one time going down and putting the penny on this track, me and about five other kids with the pennies on the tracks, and we hid in the weeds and waited for a train to come. Now, in the area where I lived, trains went by on the average of every 6 or 7 milliseconds. And in fact, the common problem around there was to be stuck for maybe 2 or 3 hours in a car, just watching trains go by. First one train, and you know, they used to coordinate their efforts. That was always good. A train is going by from left to right, okay? And there's 7,942 reefer cars going by. You know what is it, a reefer? You don't. Well, that's a refrigerator car, okay? All right, you stick with me and you'll learn all kinds of stuff. This is a fantastically educational scene here. And so the reefers are going by, see, blum, blum, blum. The old man sitting in the front seat of the car getting madder and madder. And blum, 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 they go roaring past. Blum, blum, blum. Well, then you look down to the left and you can see the caboose coming. And you see the green lights and the red lights on the caboose coming your way. And just as the caboose is about a quarter of a block away, just as at the beginning, you see all of a sudden, going the opposite direction on another track, going from right to left, is another train with 7,942 cars. So the first train goes by, and now the second one's got you. Well, they can, by clever working of the schedule, the railroads have been known to tie up the entire northern half of Indiana for maybe 4 or 5 weeks. just by running trains back and forth, cleverly. And I've seen guys, I'm not kidding you, getting so desperate after they've been waiting for 2.5 hours at a crossing, and the trains keep going back and forth, and they switch the whole bit, getting so flipped out that they try to outflank the train by turning around, driving back, cutting across. I saw a guy one time trying to outflank trains. He started in northern Indiana and did not outflank trains till he just was to the west of Dubuque, Iowa, at which point he made a right turn and proceeded to drive all the way back and finally got to South Chicago only 2.5 days after his appointment. But he did it. He outflanked the son of a gun, you know? So I'm just saying to you that there's all kinds of problems in life, and you have to accept it. So would you please give me a little of the problem music, Herbert, please? 1, 2, 3. I just feel like singing. That's enough of that. That's enough of that. Hey, you got the Sheik on that side there? I think you'll find it there. It's in there. But the reason I brought this up tonight, I suppose, I mean, we might as well go right into it. It's here. We might as well hit it. The reason I brought it up is there's a little note here that I think should be repeated here. It doesn't have much sense, but it was important enough to make the headlines. And the International Newswire. It's a news note from Warsaw. That's Poland. UPI. A fire in a coal mine in northern Poland has finally been extinguished after burning for more than 40 years. Funny. Well, of course, that's Poland, but they finally got it. They finally got it out. And there was enough of it. Can you imagine the peasants dancing around the mine? They get the fire out, and they finally celebrating. You know, they finally get the fire out, and it was very exciting when they did it. And the reason I brought that up is that I don't suppose many of you people living in this part of the country have ever seen that kind of thing. But it seems like a rather exotic news note, the fire burning for 40 years. But let me tell you this. In our neighborhood, I don't know whether any of you ever had this happen to you. You know, sometimes, have you ever had the feeling sometimes that your own life, things that happen to you, are very private things, and you're the only one that ever happened to? Some you know, completely exotic thing. But at the time, it did not seem exotic. But I was living in northern Indiana as a kid. Now, I'm going to tell you a story about an underground fire. It's one of the scariest things that happened when you're a kid. I think a lot of your viewpoint on life, a later viewpoint when you're an adult, when you have a viewpoint, is subtly conditioned by the, well, I suppose you can call it the physical characteristics of your early life, not necessarily the environment at home. You know, here in New York, we tend to believe that environment consists of what mommy and daddy say about you. But there's other sides to the environment. And not many Freudians discuss that much. At the age of 9, if you get hit by lightning, that can be a trauma. Now, daddy didn't do it and mommy didn't do it. What was it that did it? you could spend the rest of your life hiding under day beds as a result of that, and no amount of psychological analysis is ever going to get to the point that you got hit by lightning. You know, this is what happens. And it's physical. It's the physical environment. Now, if you grow up in an area where you see nothing but cars and concrete roads and buildings. You tend to think that that's the way the world really is. That's the normal world, you know. nothing but thousands of cars and a lot of people yelling and old ladies going up and down escalators at Macy's with shopping bags full of bones or whatever they carry in those shopping bags. And that's life. You figure that's the way it is. And so you will forever be conditioned by that. There's no question about it. Now, if you grow up, for example, in a state like Kansas or Nebraska, where the sky stretches forever, I mean, really, it does. And if you've ever been out in places like that, the sky is fantastic. And it's absolutely flat. You can see a car proceeding along the horizon 40 miles away. He's just driving along. Yeah, you can actually see that. Now, a person, he's going to be different. He sees the world in a different way than the guy who grew up in an apartment in Queens, who thinks that the entire world is about people. They never discuss it. Have you ever noticed that when you read certain novels, like, say, Philip Roth's books, for example, it never rains. Nothing. The people are never affected by any physical surroundings. Norman Mailer's people are never affected by the storms that roar out of the west. No way. But if you take, say, somebody like Willa Cather, now, who comes from the great underbelly of the world, the big, huge, flat plains, her people are constantly being affected by this because they are. You can't help it. So if you come from a place where the temperature drops to 40 to 50 below zero every winter, and the wind screams out of the north at 30 and 40 knots day after day, and the buildings shake as the wind howls past, and there's a brief summer, the summer suddenly breaks out in late June, and then suddenly, as it breaks out, the temperature rises to 120 inexplicably. And millions of grasshoppers then descend out of the sky and begin to eat everything in sight, including your tennis shoes. And mosquitoes are by the billion, and it's hot and steamy. And then suddenly, without warning, bap, it's winter again. The wind blows, so you're going to be different than the people who live in New York, who are the muted seasons. It's very muted seasons here. It hardly ever really gets cold here in New York. People scream bloody murder when it gets to be 7 here. I think a couple of days ago you thought that the Arctic had finally descended on Queens. But this is not cold in a lot of parts of the world, in a lot of parts of the country. And here in New York, when it gets to be 95, they had declared emergencies. They closed stores and stuff. And in the same place where the temperature is 45 below zero, and they don't think anything of 115. So, you know, the wind goes back and forth. Now, in my case, see, I grew up in northern Indiana, and I have to explain to you something about northern Indiana. It made people different than other people. Northern Indiana, and don't confuse this with little southern Indiana towns, which were hundreds of miles away. You know, people tend to do that. They're not confused about their own state, but they're confused about other states, very much so. So if you say you're from Indiana, it's Indiana, you know, barefoot boy with cheek of tan, on the shore of the Wabash, fishing for pumpkin seeds or whatever the hell they call those little fish, and that's the way it is. Well, can you imagine confusing, say, upper New York State with the Bronx? Very difficult. And yet we're both in the state, you know. New York State is New York State, whether you like it or not. But I was in the part of Indiana that was the overflow from Chicago. It was, if you can imagine, Chicago has dripped over the state line. And that's it, see. But that part of the country has its ex-lake bed. Lake Michigan hangs down there, see, and Lake Michigan had at one time been covered this part of the country, and glaciers had gone through a little bit south of us and up to the north and east. Michigan is great glacier country, so there were a lot of glacier lakes up in southern Michigan, came from glaciers, and that's, in fact, what the Great Lakes was formed by, these huge glaciers. Well, the water had come down much deeper into Indiana, in primeval days, right after the ice age had disappeared, and these lakes then slowly drew back up north, leaving this flat country that was actually sandy lake bed, just like beach sand. That's where the Indiana Dunes and all this come from. But it made a very fascinating kind of country, geographically. And if you dug down in the ground, you came across strange things, like if you dug in the sand, which we often did, we were always making caves. It's a big thing among the male children. I've never heard of girls making caves to live in. But male children do. You agree, Herb? Have you ever done it? Right. Have you, Jerry? Right. Have you ever heard of girls getting together to make a cave? Now, I'm not... This is not a misogynist remark. It's merely... Now, I'm immediately going to get 5 million letters. Yes, we made caves. Fine. Okay, I'll accept that. But I've personally never seen them do it. Have you? But nevertheless, building a cave seems to be a deep... seated urge on the part of kids, male kids, to dig a hole and crawl into it and squat and put the pieces of corrugated tin over the top and be in this cave. And we put boxes down there, and put like furniture, not really furniture, but we'd stick stuff in it, like cigarette butts and various other things which we had stashed down in our cave. And we'd squat in our cave and plot or something. I don't know what you did. It was a very mysterious atmosphere in the cave. You recall the cave? Did you ever dig a cave and put the top over it and then get in it and all the kids are in it and then you get vaguely scared of your cave? Yeah, you know, there's something down in your cave. I mean, something with claws and stuff. I mean, you have to be a believer. You do. And I think most people are believers deep down inside. You believe in Marge. With the more absorbent towels, you know that. You imagine if you walked in there and this lady starts to give you a pitch for towels, which is the more absorbent, you know. And that's all she ever talks about. You know, she never discusses anything else in that store. You've seen her do that? The quicker picker upper? You haven't. You've been protected. Your life must be very interesting out in the suburbs, Herb. They don't get that stuff out there, do they? Just crickets. I see. Well, no wonder you're beginning to feel like the backwash of life is just eddying around your Pat Boone moccasins. Incidentally, that brings up a point. Who is it who buys all those records that are advertised on Lake TV ad infinitum, ad nauseum? And now, at long last, for all of you fans of Fats McGonagall, 7,942 of his big smash hits from 1943 through 1947 are now available on Long Play Records. Who the hell buys that stuff? I mean, it seems like the record companies are reissuing all the stuff that never made it in the first place. They're clearing out the warehouses and reaping it a second time. Who buys it? Have you ever bought one of those? It's a great mystery. I don't know. I've never met anybody who did. I keep asking people. I says, hey, did you buy, the one where the guy says, they play little snatches of the songs, and one guy says, Summer in a City, and then he disappears. And the other day I asked, I took a little informal poll. I walked around and asked friends of mine, have you finally taken advantage of the big offer? 742 hits featuring your favorite singing groups of the 40s and 50s, the ones that tap dance, the Three Platters, the Three Ding Dongs, just taking advantage of that offer yet? You know, it's not going to last long. And I have not found anybody who bought any yet. But there seems to be an insatiable demand out there for used mediocrity. It would seem to me, though, that most people would be glad to get rid of their old life. You know, remind you of so many bad things. But apparently, there is a sickness afoot in the land where as soon as we have outgrown a period, and that's now generally just a decade, we immediately begin to believe that was the good old days. Now we are led to believe that the 50s were the good old days. You know, people were simple and wonderful in those days. Of course, they forget all about Joe McCarthy and other niceties of the period, and the Korean War and everything else that went on in that time. But it was a simple, nice period. People didn't have any trouble in those days, of course not. And I think that that's called the Andy Hardy syndrome. In fact, I suspect that people think that anything in the past that was, let's say, before 1967, all was a curious Andy Hardy world, where everybody sat around and shared sodas with a straw. You know, that was I never did that in my entire life. I feel really put off. Did you ever do that with anybody? I didn't. Either did you, Herb? No. Well, there's another informal poll that the stuff you were supposed to have done, you never did. I think what we're doing is rapidly putting together a non-realistic past, which had nothing to do with the way it really was. And we've all apparently lived in a gigantic Andy Hardy script in the past. It's only now that's rotten. Of course, this is an old Shepherd thesis, that one of the great illusions of man is that it used to be groovy. Oh, it used to be colorful and wonderful. People were warm. And it will be in the future when man finally grows up. It's only now that's rotten. Of course, this has persisted since Plato's time. We've never arrived at the millennia. Nor have we ever experienced the warm, soft Karo syrup glow of that curious nostalgic past, which people keep believing happened. I don't believe it. I never sat with somebody named Mary Jane and drank sodas. Sitting around, and they always show them sitting around a jukebox. You've seen that in those things there. I remember stealing hubcaps. I do recall that. But that was not necessarily nostalgic. Got shot at once doing that. Didn't do it with somebody named Mary. I never knew anybody named Mary Jane. And the idea of her sticking a straw into my soda and drinking, I said, oh, ugh, Mary Jane lips, ugh, poison. No way. But that's all part of the myth of our time, promulgated by late-night television spots. Now, I suppose the reason I have this rotten. By the way, a lot of people believe that other people lived those lives. It is firmly believed that other people had this simple, cheerful, friendly, walking around, handshaking boyhood. And they, personally, were stuck with a bunch of clods in their family, and nothing ever much happened. But it's the other guys. But this, again, is all part of the media. You have to get used to that. That's called media burn. And you can treat that. You can't cure it. You can treat it with unguentine, properly placed in certain parts and rubbed in on your psyche. But that's in passing. I'm sorry, Herb. Well, you Herb, you've seen these nostalgic things. Did you live in any of that stuff that they talk about? I don't know of anybody who did. No way. Yes. Do you remember the days when you and Mary Jane used to sit in the front seat of your car at the drive-in and listen to Fats Domino? No, come on. Come on. Most people didn't know Fats Domino was alive. And didn't know Mary Jane at all. But that's the way nostalgia goes, which is a terrible sickness of our time. And you know, speaking of that, I was struck by the similarity of this story. The Polish fire, they got the fire out, you know. You thought I'd left that, didn't you? Oh, no. Oh, no. Those hell fires burning below our feetses, our little old feetses, is always with me. The fires of hell reaching out. And, of course, I'd have to say that probably the natives in the area there, since this fire had been burning for 40 years, man or boy, that's a long time, 40 years, probably a great mythology grew up around there about the original reason for the fire as old residents died off and the fire burned on and new residents were born and grew up and the fire burned on, eventually the natives of the area there would have a whole system of fables and myths about the big fire down there at the end of the road. Well, and I know, because I speak with some genuine experience in this. When I was a kid, now you ready for a scary story? And this is why I told you about that northern Indiana geography. Things happened there that did not and could not happen here because of the actual soil we had. The fact that there had been a lake there once before. And before that, there were jungles, obviously. Back in the prehistoric times, there had been things there on the earth that are not found on seacoasts. And that's where we're living right here, on a seacoast. And I was a kid. And we used to, you know, I was just a little kid. And there were other little kids living in the neighborhood. And we were about a mile from the lake, Lake Michigan. And drive once in a while, going to different places, and you'd see glimpses of the lake off there in the middle distance. Now, the lake, in some ways, is even more lethal than the ocean. Reason being that most people know the ocean is lethal, so they give it a wide berth. But the lake has a curious, benevolent look to it, Lake Michigan. And for that reason, it becomes very dangerous. Great waves will all of a sudden, without any warning, spring up and sweep over the land. And actually, I've seen cars whip right out into the lake, right off of a main highway. Fantastic. Just seconds, 1 minute before, there were guys driving ahead of you. And the wind came up all of a sudden, and great waves would roar over, tremendous crashing waves. And I saw a car just turning end over end, just hit by a wave, just spinning end over end and down into the water, and they never did find a guy. It's very dangerous. And you'd see it occasionally, just the odd glimpses driving around. And so eventually you begin to have a sort of a curious subterranean knowledge that nature is not necessarily benevolent. In fact, it's most often the opposite. It's out to get you. It's only if you live in the big cities that you believe that nature is a beautiful, benevolent thing. I think most of those nature shows that are put on television are put on there for city people. I believe that somehow if they could get away, if they could quit the agency and go up into the wilds of Maine, buy themselves a couple of acres, you know, and they would live this Thoreauian, beautiful life up there. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing. But this is another fantasy of our time. Like every past decade was somehow kind of nice and warm. It's only now that's rotten. It's part of the myth. And we were kids growing up. Not, we weren't even growing up yet. You know, you didn't start growing up till a couple of years after that. We were just walking around kids. And down at the end of the street, we had this. There were prairies around there. This was large prairie country. And off to the west, in fact, just next to the school I went to, which was the Warren G. Harding School, was an enormous primitive swamp that stretched for dozens and actually probably around 15 or 20 miles. It was a big swamp. And cattails, snakes, nobody ever went there. A real swamp. If you've ever lived next to a swamp, that's not at all like living next to an ocean or a lake or a river. A swamp has a curious, very distinct, sinister air to it. One of my most favorite names in America is the name of a great swamp, the Dismal Swamp. Ever hear of it? That's a great name. Really a great name, the Dismal Swamp. And I used to always, when I was a kid, I used to read books where the Boy Scout troop or whatever it was, the hero, Tom Slade. You ever hear of Tom Slade? Tom Slade was a heroic kid that was a Boy Scout. Tom Slade and the Dismal Swamp. Well, the swamp, you see, has a curious romance about it. Not only romance, but a deep strain of menace to it. And so on the one side, we had the swamp. And to the north was Lake Michigan. Those great 10, 15-foot waves. And that deep, deep, icy water. And all of a sudden, down at the end of the street, a vacant lot, where almost near where we played baseball, we used to play ball as kids, there was an underground fire. Now, have you ever seen an underground fire? If you've never seen one, there's nothing quite like it. It's truly an underground fire. And nobody knew where it started. Just a wisp of smoke constantly hanging over this big vacant lot. It was almost it was more than a vacant lot. It was a vacant field, really. And there was a blue haze that would hang over this place all the time. And you couldn't see it. An underground fire does not burst into flames. You never saw any flames. Just this blue smoke, and I can still remember the pungent smell of it. It had a very distinct, sharp, pungent smell to it. Did not smell like wood burning, which it wasn't. It was not wood that was burning. It didn't smell like coal that was burning, because it wasn't coal. It was an underground fire. And us kids used to go down. We'd walk on the way to the store or something. We'd walk past this vacant lot and see this kind of weedy, blackened, charred ground out there, just stretched over a whole big area there. And there'd be this soft wisp of blue, very thin, ghostly smoke rising out of it. And all the kids had ideas, you know, all kinds of theories about it. In fact, there was a rumor that all kids, they didn't think of it as a rumor, it's an absolute truth, that two kids had once fallen in there and had never been seen again. They'd just simply been burned up. That was it. They were gone. And so we'd approached this with a great deal of stealth. Because, one, we weren't supposed to go there. And, two, if there's something like that in your immediate vicinity, you are drawn to it because you are a human being. Now, if you were told that down the end of the street there was a great big sudden development of a lake of quicksand, would you go to see it? That's right. Oh, by the way, we also had quicksand. The swamp had areas that were recognized as dangerous because in that swamp they actually had quicksand. Have you ever seen quicksand? Well, there were always rumors about the quicksand, too, that if you even put your foot on it, you know, movies tend to augment that rumor. If you stuck your foot out and stuck your foot on the quicksand, it'd suck you right in, you know, and you're hanging onto the bank and sucks you right down. Well, we had quicksand, but this haze that hung over the vacant lot was very definitely there, and you could see it, and you could smell it. And that smell is so much in my memory. You probably have memory yourself of about maybe 15 or 20 smells that you never smell again, but you've never forgotten them. The smell. A smell, and you smell it occasionally. If you ever smell that smell again, you'll recognize it instantly. For example, one of the smells that I have never forgotten is a smell of high explosive powder used in heavy bore rifles. If you've ever smelled that smell after somebody's fired off a .30-06, you know that smell, and it doesn't smell like anything else. It does not smell like fireworks. It smells like heavy caliber fire. That's what it smells like. You agree, Herb? You just don't forget it. Now, the smell of the underground fire, I've never forgotten. It's a smell that I wish I could tell you. It's a sharp, it's not an unpleasant smell. It's a, Doesn't smell like the dumps over here in Jersey burning. No way. It's a smell that has a sharp, almost aromatic quality to it. But it is a distinct smell. And it just went on and on and on. Year after year, that blue smoke would hang over that vacant lot, the underground fire. And once in a while, we got so we just, you know, it was so much part of our life, we just accepted it. Nobody talked about the underground fire. Just accepted it. Once in a great while, somebody would talk about it. Like, you'd be hanging around a playground, somebody'd say, hey, you know, that thing started. Well, what it is that's burning down there? Yeah, you know. You'd just say, oh, I don't know. And nobody ever quite knew when it started. But all they knew was it went on and on and on. The smell of the underground fire just never stopped until that one fantastic day. That the underground fire had been going as long as I could remember. And now I was about 15 when this thing happened. And I had been a little kid when I first heard about the underground fire. So probably was going on for 10 years. Who knows how long it went before that. Well, one day, it was in the afternoon. It was on a Saturday afternoon. We were about, I'd say about 4 o'clock, roughly like that. And it was in late winter. See, an underground fire never stops, winter or summer. It goes on and on. This was late winter. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when, without any warning, I was back by the garage and Schwartz was walking around out in the alley and the snow was around and it was cold and kind of raining, you know, on Saturday afternoon you just sort of fool around and there's not much to do and it was kind of a bitter day when all of a sudden, without any warning, there was a tremor, something you felt. You didn't hear it. It just boom, made a sort of boom, like a distant, faraway explosion. And then, almost immediately, you heard people shouting in the distance, hey, whoa, 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 and you heard sirens and stuff. And we ran down the front and out to the front of the street, because it was out in front somewhere. And over the vacant lot where this underground fire had been, was a tremendous mushroom-shaped cloud that just went up and up and up. It was a genuine mushroom-shaped cloud. It looked like an atomic cloud, a littler one, but it was a definite mushroom-shaped cloud. And everybody's running down the street to this place. I mean, people were running down there, and so, of course, we got in the crowd. We're running down there, and the entire field had dropped out of sight. And now there was a gigantic hole where the underground fire had been, and you could just see nothing but great black boiling clouds of this acrid, bitter smoke rising and dust. And the fire department comes, and immediately they put up all kinds of barricades. Stay away from the underground fire. And all of us kids stood around and looked inside that great big hole and saw that great drifting clouds coming out of that hell that had suddenly... None of us were surprised. Because the mythology of the kid world had said since time immemorial that there was some giant hole in hell down there and that kids did fall in this place. We wouldn't have been surprised to see the bones of kids, generations of kids down there in that deep Stygian pit, the burning fires of the netherworld. And the people stood around and looked at it, watched. And a few stories came out in the papers, apocryphal stories, that many, many centuries ago that there had been some kind of a mine there where they were mining peat. There was peat below the surface of our ground out there. You know what peat is like? You know what it is? And that they had been mining peat, and that there was a mine there. But nobody ever really found out what it was. It just burned on and on, even with the great pit yawning to the sky. See, there are now. I can just see the Polish peasants dancing around their 40-year fire. And they'll miss it. Even though they celebrated when the fire was out, they will miss it. Because the one thing that gave mystery to their lives was that wisp of black smoke rising from the underground fire. Yes, just below your feet, God knows what lies. Alligators and the subways. Rats, snakes, beavers, evil of all kinds.